This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on August 21st, 2008. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The open session of the Federal Election Commission on Thursday, August 21st, 2008 will now come to order. Morning. First item on the agenda is the correction and approval of minutes.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of the minutes of July 28th, 2008.
All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Ayes have it, 6-0. Before we move to the agenda, a couple announcements. We've named an acting staff director. Had that vacancy for some time. The commission came together and selected Mr. Joe Stultz, who has been with the commission for quite some time. Seated to our left, your right, Mr. Stultz is a certified public accountant and currently also serves not only as the acting staff director but the head of the audit division. He joined the commission in 1976 and has been an invaluable asset to the commission, and one of those who attend these meetings or otherwise read transcripts to know that. And welcome Joe to his new role, and on behalf of all the commissioners, we very much appreciate you willing to serve on an interim basis to help us through what has been an interesting transition given the dormancy of the commission for some time. So on behalf of the commission, thank you.
Thank you. We'll do our best.
Had some applause. We hold applause to the end here. The other thing I'd like to say before we get going on what we're going to do today, we have several advisory opinions on the agenda, and then an item at the end. We're going to stick with our usual agenda of doing the advisory opinions first. Something that prior chairman and some commissioners thought was a good idea and I embraced and trying to push even further is to move advisory opinions through the system sooner rather than later, because I feel that people, and I would say we feel that people need advice sooner rather than later, particularly in an election year. So any sort of critical election issue we're trying to resolve quickly, at least in a way that balances the speed with the thoughtfulness and try to get the right result, because people need real answers to real questions in real time. It doesn't do, for example, the Virginia Democratic Party any good to know what they can and can't do with their slate cards 2 weeks before the election, because they need to plan in advance. So we're moving things very quickly. And I really want to thank the staff, particularly Office of General Counsel, for cooperating. Amy Rothstein, Rosie Smith, David Atkins, Eugene Lynch of the counsel's office have been very critical in this. There'll be other presenters here today, and I'll recognize them. I see Johnny Levin in the front row, for example. These folks have worked very hard to and been humored me in many ways to try to move these forward. Darlene Harris from the Secretary's office and Jason Buccoletto from Public Records and Blake Lang from IT stayed very late last night to put these things up on the website. You see many drafts. It takes a tremendous amount of work to get this stuff out the door, and I never realized until I got here how much work it takes behind the scenes to simply get one advisory opinion through the process. So on behalf of all of us, thank you very much. Moving to the agenda. First item, draft advisory opinion 2008-04, a request from Senator Dodd, and presenting is going to be Joanna Waldsteiger from the Office of General Counsel.
I'd like to remove late submitted document.
Okay, before we present, we're going to have a motion regarding late submitted documents.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to suspend the rules on timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document number 0819 and 0819A.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. I guess we could have done that one without objection, but that passes 6-0. Proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, commissioners. The two alternative draft advisory opinions before you respond to a request submitted by counsel for Chris Dodd for President, Inc., the principal presidential campaign committee for Senator Christopher Dodd. During the course of Senator Dodd's presidential primary campaign, the committee accepted contributions designated for the general election, keeping them segregated from primary election contributions. Senator Dodd withdrew from the presidential race on January 3, 2008, and became a candidate for the U.S. Senate in 2010. In light of the fact that Senator Dodd accepted funds under the Matching Payment Act, the committee seeks permission to refund contributions designated for the general election, or to obtain written redesignation of those contributions to Senator Dodd's senatorial campaign. The committee also seeks confirmation that the costs of refunding contributions and obtaining redesignations are considered winding down costs and may therefore be paid for with presidential primary election funds. Both draft advisory opinions conclude that the costs of refunding and obtaining redesignations of contributions are winding down costs and may be paid for with primary election funds. Both drafts also conclude that the committee may refund or obtain redesignations for contributions designated for the general election for up to 6 days after receipt of the advisory opinion. Agenda document 0819 emphasizes that this extension of the 60-day periods that the regulations permit to refund contributions or obtain redesignations is due only to the unprecedented and unforeseen circumstances at the time this advisory opinion was requested, the Commission's lack of quorum and consequent inability to respond to the request for several months. Draft B follows Advisory Opinion 1992-15 in concluding that the 60-day period begins to run on the date the candidate has actual notice of the need to refund contributions or obtain redesignations, and in granting the candidate the balance of the 60-day period that remained after submission of the advisory opinion request because of the novel legal questions posed. We received no comments on the advisory opinion request or on either draft. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have on either draft. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the commissioners? Commissioner Hunter.
Mr. Chairman, with respect to draft B, as noted by the council, this draft does allow the senator to refund or redesignate funds he received as a candidate for his party's presidential nomination, and it allows him 6 days after receipt of this opinion to do so, relying on the commission's precedent set in Advisory Opinion 1992-15, the Russo Advisory Opinion, in that the question presented before the commission in the opinion in Draft B is a novel question because Senator Dodd was the first candidate, as far as we know, to accept public primary funds in the primary presidential election and receive general election funds for the general election and to have lost them. So at this point, and to have lost the election, at this point, we allow the candidate to use those funds raised while he was a primary candidate to redesignate them to his senatorial campaign despite the restriction on post ineligibility spending in 11 CFR 9034.4B3. Thank you.
I have a few comments, then I'm looking to see if anyone else wants to speak. But essentially, we have two drafts before us, as I see it, that reach the same result but get there different ways. And I think there is a tension in the regs between the matching fund regime of the primary that Senator Dodd availed himself of and the ability to transfer money that he raised for the general election over to a different election. Without the matching fund regime, I think it's a very easy question. Obviously, he could do that so long as he complies with commission regs. But there is, I think, a unique question presented because of an evolution in the law. There was an advisory opinion that was actually issued to Senator Obama regarding the ability to raise general election money, yet not forego the opportunity to partake in the public financing with the general. I think that was an opinion correctly decided. And because of that, there are going to be additional questions which arise, and this is one of them. The real question, though, is I think we all agree how that he can do it. Just question is when. One draft gets there because the commission was shut down for 6 months and thus the Dodd campaign could not get an answer. The other cites a prior advisory opinion. I'm more inclined to support that draft. I just find that draft more persuasive. But we both drafts get to the same place. So this is in many ways maybe just an illustration of how different commissioners will approach issues, but yet how hopefully the commission still comes out on the same result after having gotten there different ways. Any other comments, thoughts, concerns from the commissioners? Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt agenda document number, advisory opinion 2008-04, draft B.
Motion is on draft B. All in favor of draft B, say aye.
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 All opposed?
Nay.
That fails 3-3, the three being Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, and myself, McGann, and then Vice Chair Walther, Commissioners Bowerly and Weintraub voting in opposition. Another motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move adoption of agenda document A, which is agenda document number 0819, which is, I believe we're considering it, that to be draft A.
Motion is on draft A. All in favor?
Aye.
Say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No.
No.
Draft A fails 3-3. The opposite vote. Commissioners Weintraub, Bowerly, Walther voting in favor, the remainder voting in opposition.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd move that we instruct our council to, since we all agree on the outcome, but we have differing points of view on how to get there, that we instruct council to return to us with a draft that basically points out that under the circumstances, we agree to the request as indicated in both drafts, but that we delete the portions that for which we have conflicting views.
On that motion, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? 6-0. Unanimous vote on the result. Question from the council.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. One question. We note that our time period to respond to Senator Dodd is September 2nd.
Okay.
So it wasn't clear to me. Is the commission's preference that we return this as a tally vote document?
I would suggest the quickest way we can do it, which would be tally vote.
Okay.
I envision it as saying the question and then yes, and then much shorter than the drafts, I would imagine. So yes, sooner the better.
Okay.
Thank you. Next item, advisory opinion request from the Democratic Party of Virginia. General Counsel's office, we're going to have David Atkins and Johnny Levin. Before we present, the Vice Chair has a motion.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents 0821 and 0821A in connection with this matter.
All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? 6-0. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning to the other commissioners. The two alternative draft advisory opinions before you, agenda document 0821, which I'll refer to as draft A, and agenda document 08-21A, which I'll refer to as draft B, respond to an advisory opinion request submitted by counsel for the Democratic Party of Virginia. The Democratic Party of Virginia is a state party committee that is registered with the commission as a political committee. In connection with the 2008 general election, the committee plans to prepare and distribute publications featuring the party's candidates who are running for state or federal office in the state of Virginia. These publications will include information about the election, as well as abstract designs, images, and candidate photos. Both committee employees and volunteers will distribute these publications by mail and by hand, and will be encouraged to converse with recipients of the publications. The committee asks two questions. First, whether its publications qualify as exempt from the definitions of contribution and expenditure, and second, if so, whether there exists any restrictions on the manner in which the committee's volunteers or employees may distribute the publications. With respect to each of the committee's questions, both drafts A and B analyze separately publications distributed by volunteers and publications distributed by committee employees. For publications distributed by volunteers, both drafts A and B conclude with respect to question one that the publications will qualify as exempt under the volunteer activity exemption. With respect to question two, both drafts conclude that the manner in which volunteers may distribute publications under the volunteer activity exemption is unrestricted. For publications distributed by committee employees, both drafts A and B reach different conclusions on both questions one and two. On question one, draft B concludes that publications distributed by committee employees that use candidate photographs in the supplementary manner proposed by the requester qualify for the slate card exemption. Draft A concludes they do not. On question two, draft B concludes that the slate card exemption does not restrict the manner in which committee employees may distribute the publications. Alternatively, draft A concludes that under the slate card exemption, committee employees must limit the verbal message delivered with the slate card in order for the distribution costs to be exempt. Draft A makes clear, however, that nothing said by a committee employee during distribution will remove the costs associated with the production of that publication under the exemption. We received two comments on these drafts, and I'm happy to address any questions or comments you may have. Thank you.
Questions by the commission? No comments. Well, then I will go. I am in favor of draft. Make sure I get the right draft here in front of me. Draft B, sorry. Draft A, and I note that we received some late comments on this. The comments have come from the requester, filed through council, the Virginia Democratic Party, and also comments from the Democratic National Committee, also submitted through council, both of whom support draft B, the draft I support. And I share the analysis and the thoughts that they have on this with respect to draft A. I think draft A is unnecessarily restrictive and produces probably some unintended consequences with respect to how party programs operate in the country for both party committees and for those who are not a member of either party committee, their own party committee. I don't want to necessarily say there's only two parties. But regardless of one's party affiliation, I think the notion of doing retail politics as it was formally understood, I think, is very important. I think those who passed the Federal Election Campaign Act in the 70s did not want to limit that, although apparently it had some limits, so they had to amend the law in the late 70s, a few years later, to try to restore some of the grassroots politics. So the so-called slate card exemption is one of those. And all it really says is you can print up slate cards that it does not count against any sort of spending limit. It does not, would not be a contribution to those candidates. The slate cards have been handed out since then. The Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act was passed, and before the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act was passed, and after the Bipartisan Campaign Act was passed, slate cards were handed out, and people said whatever they wanted to say in handing out the slate card. BICRA, as it's called, did not change that. What it did change, perhaps, is how you pay for it, because it's introduced the concept of federal election activity. So therefore, what we're looking at today, particularly this request, given that it is Virginia, where they don't have non-federal elections in the federal election years, you're looking at all hard money. So you're looking at an all hard money party program that would allow for folks to go door to door. The real trouble I have with draft A is how it limits what you can and cannot say in handing out slate cards. The comment from the requester states you could only imagine. It essentially says you can only imagine how this would work. They said I'd love to help you be a better informed voter, but that could take 2 minutes, and they do not have any 44-1AD authority with me today. So sorry, please don't ask me any additional questions. So you're really limited to saying what's only on the slate card, and you can't go beyond the slate card. If you do, draft A, in fairness, does not prevent you from saying that. It just imposes additional restrictions and burdens on how you pay for it, and I would suggest that's going to be unworkable to the point where it'll kill off the whole point of the slate card exception. Very few folks really do a lot of slate cards anymore because they look kind of dated. And I like the idea of allowing for a little bit more flair on the slate cards, a little more eye-catching. To me, slate cards depend on the content, not the pictures. However, if a picture conveys some content, I think that could run afoul of the slate card exception. But the real gist of the issue is really, to me, how party committees do their get-out-the-vote operations. And the real choice for me is whether or not we're going to encourage door-to-door politics where people paid for by a party committee can go and actually talk to people one-on-one and hand out some literature and say, here's the slate I believe in, please go vote for them on election day, or are we going to continue to push the money from that sort of program into independent expenditures and robocalls and that kind of thing? The reality is the kind of money that you're going to spend on these programs is not that much compared to the millions and millions of dollars spent on TV. And it seems to me if someone spends, a party committee spends $50,000 on printing and door-to-door, I would rather have them do that than spend $50,000 on robocalls. The money is going to be spent regardless, so I think the agency ought to encourage the right kind of spending. To me, draft B is wholly consistent with the statute. The statute itself says the cost of distribution is included in the slate card exemption, so if you are distributing a slate card, that cost comes under the slate card exemption and thus not subject to a spending limit. My final point is folks who work for parties who distribute things door-to-door tend not to work in K Street law firms or Wall Street brokerage houses or that sort of thing. It is not as easy as it sounds to describe to people what they can and cannot say in context of elections. If one looks at recent Supreme Court cases on what is express advocacy, one can see that very intelligent people can disagree on where the lines are. And when you get into retail politics, particularly in more urban areas, it's very difficult to explain abstract legal concepts to folks that really don't make a lot of sense unless you have a very detailed understanding of federal election law. And I can only imagine trying to explain to people, you're being paid today to deliver these slate cards, and you're being paid up front to deliver the slate cards, because if you're working kind of as a day worker, that's how it works. But if you say the wrong thing, you're going to have to come back to us because we're going to have to pay you a different kind of money. It's very troubling to me. To me, it should be much easier for parties to operate in the retail political level, and I am confident that those who sponsored, at least on the House side, and voted for Shays Meehan, which became BICRA, one of their goals was to return politics more to the traditional grassroots, not the more innovative, independent of campaign type spending. So with that, I'm in favor of draft P. Any other comments? Do we have a motion?
Let me just point out a little bit on that. In a couple of areas, I certainly disagree with agree with the chairman on a number of issues, but for me, the slate card exemption is simply that. It's a slate card, and it is for the purpose of identifying for a voter who's on the slate and a little bit of information. But it's not to be a promotional piece, it's not to be a sales piece, it's to be an informational piece. And my concern is not, I have no problem with embellishing it with graphics and that kind of thing. I think that's great. That's a neutral message, but when you run the risk of then taking photographs, like we've said in the past, excessive biography information, and it becomes more of a promotional piece, then I think we find ourselves in the slippery slope of trying to sliver off different ways in which to characterize things, and we find ourselves making it more difficult than it needs to be in order to accomplish the objective of advising the people who is on that slate and a little bit of information about them. If we want to go beyond that, then of course that can be done, but it seems to me that when we're getting beyond what the original intent of it was, and it also puts us in the situation of where it's hard for us to draw those kind of lines. If we were to, perhaps if we get to the point of talking about language, we can tighten that up some way, but we're not there at the moment. There's some other issues of difference as well.
Mr. Ballard.
Thank you. With respect to draft B, I agree that with the approach it takes on with respect to the content of the slate cards. I agree that once photos get into T-shirts that have slogans or other sort of messages, that may pull those photographs and then the slate card out from the exemption, but until it reaches that point, in my view, additional photographs are not problematic with respect to the content piece. I think where we have some disagreement, as I understand it, is with respect to the view of how committee employees distribute and what, in my view, committee employees can say whatever they like when they are distributing those, but we have lots of other provisions in the Act and in our regulations which at times require allocation between different pots of money, not necessarily which pots of money someone may be paid with, but whether those must be considered a contribution, perhaps. I don't think we have to get into the nuances of it, but my concern about the approach in draft B is that it seems to throw the door a little too wide open for me. I don't believe a slate card should become a get out of all regulation free card. I think that it should, the distribution costs with the slate card are exempt. The production costs are clearly exempt. But for example, if someone were distributing 10 items, one of which is a slate card, it seems to me that slate card exemption can't swallow the cost for the exemption as a whole, and that's my concern. And I do think that draft A states that existing regulations and other provisions of the Act may still apply to this activity, and to that extent that they've been implemented by party committees, I think they could still accomplish that. Thank you.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't really happy with either of the drafts. It seemed to me that neither one of them was really perfect. Like Commissioner Bowerly, I prefer draft B on the content. I'm not worried about pictures of the Shenandoah Mountains or Skyline Drive or Virginia Beach, although were I to vote for this, I would ask for one amendment. There's a phrase in there that talks about photographs of diverse groups of fresh-faced Virginians, and I don't actually know what that means. And I think perhaps we should take that phrase out of there. I gather that came from a conversation that was held between our staff and the requester. And
I believe that did come from the requester. I'm not sure I understand what it is either, but in my view, it's not inconsistent with the statutory limitations on the slate card. So even if they're fresh-faced or poker-faced or sour-faced or old-faced or new-faced or ugly-faced or good-looking-faced, it does not change the fact that the slate card would still be a slate card.
Don't argue with me too much, Mr. Chairman, because I just might agree with you.
I wasn't arguing. I was just attempting to clarify and assist you in your thinking.
I think that Commissioner Bowerly also raises a good point about, you know, distributing a whole lot of materials and you've got a slate card in there, and therefore, you know, you believe that you put yourself in a whole different category. I'm going to make a leap of faith here and assume that that's not actually what the requester is talking about. Were I to discover that that's what the requester was talking about, I would have a different view of it. But if all we're talking about is walking around handing out slate cards, I think it probably is just unworkable to try and limit too much what people are saying as they're walking around and handing these things out. So since I don't actually like to impose rules that don't make sense and aren't workable in practice, while I'm not 100% comfortable, as I said, with either draft, I would be willing to support draft B if you'll take out fresh-faced. How about that? How's that for a deal, Mr. Chairman?
Well, let me think about that. I anticipated fresh face. But the commissioner does raise a very good point. The request asks a narrow question. It does not ask the question as to what if you handed a slate card and a bunch of other stuff. It asks the question, what if you hand out a slate card? What can you say handing out the slate card? So to me, I could see a separate issue. Not sure I would change my result, but I could certainly acknowledge there's a separate issue with respect to what if you do something else in addition to handing out slate cards. But the request asked the question, what about handing out slate cards, not what about handing out all kinds of pieces or what if we have the allocate or any of that other stuff. It's a very narrow question. On draft B, Commissioner, I need to ask you a question. Where is the – oh, here it is.
It's on page 2, line 7.
I see it. Yes, here. Let's see. This is what the requester wants to add. They want to add an American flag. We're in favor of the American flag. Is okay, right? Okay.
Absolutely.
Scenery from the Commonwealth of Virginia. You mentioned that, Skyline Drive. Okay. Photographs of diverse groups of fresh-faced Virginians. I'm in favor of photographs of fresh-faced Virginians. So if it's okay, I'd actually ask if there's a motion on the draft as is. See how that goes, and if that fails, then we're happy to consider the amendment and cross out fresh face and vote on that.
See, what I'm thinking about, Mr. Chairman, is that I know my mother's watching us on C-SPAN right now, and she's a Marylander, so she wouldn't be covered by this in any event. But I would hate to think that somebody would tell her that she couldn't be in the picture because she's, you know, a little bit older than perhaps some of the commissioners at the table today.
Oh, so you just wish to strike fresh-faced in quotes, not the concept of people with pictures.
No. Just that term.
I'm sorry.
Just that term. I want to make sure it truly is a diverse group of Virginians.
Okay,
I think you're right.
That makes some sense. I just took the requester's request on face value. So if we have a motion on draft B as amended by striking the fresh-faced in quotes on page 2, line 7, do we have a motion?
So moved.
Thank you. Motion on draft B as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed say no.
No,
that carries 4-2 with Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, McGann, and Weintraub voting in favor, and Commissioners Bowerly and Walter voting in opposition. Take it we can move to the next item on the agenda, and all these other drafts and notes that I had we can now put away. Next item, draft, is an advisory opinion request from Senator David Vitter. General Counsel's Office, we're going to have Jessica Selenkoff presenting. Does I understand it? Yes. How are you? Before you present, the Vice Chair would like to make a motion regarding the various agenda documents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document 0820 on this matter.
Motion is pending. I was not listening. I apologize, Mr. Vice Chair. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Take it away.
Good morning, Commissioners. The two alternative draft advisory opinions before you respond to a request by Senator David Vitter and his principal campaign committee, David Vitter, for U.S. Senate. Senator Vitter incurred over $200,000 in legal fees in connection with a criminal proceeding against a third party, Ms. Deborah Palfrey. The legal fees were incurred in monitoring the Palfrey proceeding, quashing subpoenas in the Palfrey proceeding, consulting on press relations, and assisting separate counsel who represented Senator Vitter before the Senate Ethics Committee. Senator Vitter has already paid approximately $70,000 of these legal fees. Senator Vitter and the committee ask whether the committee may use campaign funds to pay or reimburse Senator Vitter for these legal fees. Agenda document number 820 concludes that the committee's payment of or reimbursement for legal fees for press relations and consultations with the Ethics Council would not be a conversion to personal use because these legal fees would not exist irrespective of Senator Vitter's campaign or duties as a U.S. Senator, but that the committee's payment of or reimbursement for legal fees for quashing the subpoenas and monitoring the Palfrey proceeding would constitute personal use under the Act and Commission regulations. Agenda document 820A concludes that the committee may pay or reimburse Senator Vitter for all legal fees in connection with the Palfrey proceeding, because none of the legal fees would exist irrespective of Senator Vitter's campaign or duties as a U.S. Senator. We have received one comment from Senator Vitter on the alternate drafts. I'm available for any questions you have. Thank you.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since Commissioner Weintraub invoked her mother earlier, I will do the same with mine, my mother, while I was growing up, would always tell me to emphasize the positives. So let me start off by emphasizing where I believe all six of the commissioners stand. It appears that we all agree that with respect to legal expenses that are incurred as a result of dealing with an ethics committee investigation or dealing with press relations communication strategy, that we agree that campaign funds may be used in those circumstances. It's on the other areas where we may have some disagreement. So let me at least start with where we agree before we go where we may be disagreeing. Determining the scope of the what is a permissible use of campaign funds, what's personal use, what's not, is as I was going through these cases, I didn't find it to be a particularly easy exercise. It's a very fact-intensive undertaking, and as a result, the commission has typically taken a case-by-case approach, and I think that that recognizes the reality that it's hard to draw easily definable lines and then put certain items within those parameters. I found that what sounds simple in theory is oftentimes more difficult in practice, and as in this particular case, as General Counsel's office has pointed out, we have four boxes that we've formed. Basically, one for the ethics investigation, one for dealing with the press, one for monitoring a criminal case, and one for quashing the subpoenas. And then we kind of make determinations with what items go within each box and how much or of one's campaign funds can be used to, can be spent to offset legal expenses and which how much can't. As I was going through this case, I went back and forth on a number of times as to how we should, what rule we should actually apply. As I was going through the precedents, I thought they provided a lot of guidance too. There were some unique facts in this current case that didn't fit neatly with some of the others. But one thing that stood out to me is as we were applying the irrespective test, which again can be a somewhat difficult test to apply, one thing that made the decision a little bit easier in this case was the fact that the defendant in the underlying criminal case, which the defendant which subpoenaed the requester in this case, in essence announced what her strategy was. She was going to drag into, as part of her defense strategy, was going to subpoena high-profile names who were on a list of over 15,000 individuals that were on phone lists that were disclosed. And basically, the higher the profile, the public figure, the more likely they were going to be brought in. 14,996 folks didn't have to worry. Excuse me, 14,994 were off the hook. Six were brought in, and the defendant in that case made it very clear the reasons why she was bringing in certain of those individuals. And I thought it was also interesting that, with respect to the requester, the subpoenas were issued, but there was never any requirement that person testify, which again indicates that this really was part of a defense strategy, and that they were targeted not in terms of their value really for as a witness, but really in terms of bringing in someone who was high profile. And this was acknowledged openly in the press, and for me that was a rather compelling fact. I know that there's unlikely going to be an agreement on this issue. I know that that three of my colleagues believe that the cost for monitoring, for example, monitoring the criminal case, that those should not be, that the costs that were incurred with respect to that should not be paid for out of campaign funds, because it is their opinion, and an opinion I respect, that would have happened irrespective of whether or not the requester was a senator. I have, in my own mind, I find that difficult to believe. I really don't believe that the other 14,994 individuals who were on those phone logs retained separate counsel to monitor that criminal case. I think that the reason why requester was brought in and subpoenaed was because of his status as a public official. And he needed to maintain criminal counsel as a result, because of his status as a public official. In these cases, there's sometimes a temptation, I think, to and I'm speaking as myself. I don't attribute this to any of my colleagues. To sometimes maybe take a peek into what the underlying offense may have been, and then determine, is this guy a good guy or is this guy a bad guy, and let's make the determination along those lines. And I guess that will always be a temptation in all of these cases that we address. But I also think that in many of these matters, no charges are actually brought against the requesters, and that temptation always needs to be withstood. And again, I'm speaking for myself, not for anyone else. I am concerned that when individuals decide to run for public office, that they become a target, and legal actions can be lodged against them. They may not be precisely, the underlying action may not deal precisely with campaign or official duties, but they are being targeted because of their official status. And I'm worried about making congressmen, senators, making them human shields for indicted criminal defendants. And so again, in this case, the requester was never an indication that he was a target. So really, the monitoring that he was doing with respect to the underlying criminal case was really to help him out in an ethics investigation, which was going on, an ethics investigation, which all six of us agree is a proper form where the requester may use campaign funds to offset legal expenses. In past precedents, we have acknowledged that that as public officials, there is a political necessity to respond to allegations, even if the underlying allegation doesn't relate to campaign or official duties, and that there is a heightened scrutiny that goes along with being a public official. And so, in this case, really where the requester was at greatest risk was with respect to an ethics investigation. There was a complaint that was filed before the ethics committee, and as a result, he had to monitor the criminal case, because what was going on in that criminal case was forming the basis for what the complaint before the ethics committee, what they were considering. So in this case, I'm going to support draft B, which would permit the requester to offset all of his legal expenses with campaign funds, because I believe that none of them would have arisen but for the fact that he was a public official.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I also appreciate that there are areas of agreement here, which is always a good thing, but there are also areas of disagreement. I don't think this is about whether the senator is a good guy or a bad guy. I think what we're being asked to decide is, were certain expenses, did they result from campaign or officeholder activities? Would they have existed irrespective of the candidate's campaign or duties as a federal officeholder? I think pretty plainly the expenses at issue resulted from pretty unofficial activities. And the commission has in recent years taken a hard look at what the legal expenses pertain to and has not given a blank check to members of Congress that just because they have campaign funds, they can use them to cover all of their legal expenses. Yes, members of Congress do have heightened scrutiny. If a member of Congress were in a messy divorce, then that would make the papers and it would be embarrassing, but I don't think we would say that he could use campaign funds to hire the best divorce lawyer in town so that he came out looking better in his divorce trial. If a member of Congress held real estate and the tenants said, we want you to fix the plumbing, and we're going to picket in front of your Senate office and embarrass you if you don't do something about it, he couldn't take his campaign funds and hire a plumber to fix the plumber in his real estate as a landlord. And I think that the expenses of monitoring a criminal trial and these arising out of these kinds of activities and quashing a subpoena that was levied against him are essentially personal activities. And there were, I believe, other men around town who were lawyering up when all this hit the newspapers. He wasn't the only guy in town who was nervous. Undoubtedly, not all 14,000 hired lawyers, but I bet some of them did, people who were prominent in other areas of life who were afraid that they might get drawn in. And I bet a lot of people were watching that trial pretty darn closely. It's a fact of life that members of Congress do get heightened scrutiny, and some of them like the publicity that they get in other contexts, and sometimes you get some bad publicity. It is not the case that there's no such thing as bad publicity. There certainly is. We've seen over the years various senators have to deal with that. But these were, in my view, not expenses that resulted from campaign or officeholder activities in any way. And I believe he still would have had them. And it would have been irresponsible. He did hire, even the senator concedes there were certain activities of his criminal defense lawyer that would not be covered by his campaign funds. And, you know, I think it would have been irresponsible for that lawyer not to be monitoring the trial and not to be seeking to quash that subpoena. When you have a subpoena levied against you, you got to do something about it. So I support document 08-20, which I guess is draft A in our parlance. I think it reaches the right result. I think it allows the senator, consistent with previous practice, to use campaign funds to when there are ethics charges levied against him at the Senate Ethics Committee, because those are only charges that are levied against him because he is a senator. Otherwise, they wouldn't have jurisdiction over him. So we're not saying he can't use any campaign funds at all. What draft A says is that he just can't use campaign funds for all of his legal expenses pertaining to this matter.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support draft A for the same reasons as Commissioner Weintraub. Just to add to that, the statute is clear to me that you either look at two really factors here: can a candidate's election campaign or the individual's duties as an office holder. Now, I grant you that after the adoption of that statute, it's gravitated to the point where you can look at the person's status. But that's really not in the statute. It's not in the regs. It is something we recognize, but I'm not personally inclined to expand that when it involves trying to fight a subpoena for a lawful proceeding in a criminal matter. And at that particular point, a judgment has to be made. Do I want to be a witness or do I not? And I don't think it's our call to have campaign funds be used for that purpose. The conduct did not arise. It may be different if the criminal matter involves something that related to the duties of the campaign, but it did not. So then you have to look at, well, why are we doing this? And I can't think of a reason why we would want to expand the interpretation for that. That also applies to monitoring a criminal trial. That is an election that someone makes because they're undoubtedly concerned about what might be said. But I don't think that's a basis for us to, especially in a case like this where the individual is not involved in the trial as a defendant, or so to have someone sit and monitor a trial of another person for a criminal event does not seem to me to be a sensible way to embellish upon the use of the word status. And that's really what we're talking about here. It's not duties, let's face it. It's not campaign activity, let's face it. It's the status link that's been expanded upon in some of our AOs since the adoption of the statute. And to me, it would be an expansion that doesn't make much sense, and it's outside the intent of what was the law really, I think, intended.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make one response to Vice Chairman Walther. I think if this were a matter of first impression, I may very well see things like you do. As I was studying through this issue, you know, when you start with the statute and then look at the context in which the agency has interpreted that statute, it's had occasion on a number of occasions to analyze this text in the advisory opinion context. And there are a number of advisory opinions: the Hilliard advisory opinion, the Cooley advisory opinion, the Costello advisory opinion, which I think are consistent and support the finding, the approach that we are looking at in draft B. I acknowledge that there are some more recent advisory opinions which appear to be taking a bit of a different course, but as I was looking at those advisory opinions, they both involved individuals who got everything they asked for because it was found that everything related close enough to a campaign or official duty. And then there would be kind of a boilerplate sentence saying, but if something didn't apply to, you know, if you incur legal expenses that aren't related to campaign or official duties, then you may not use campaign funds. but really, that statement was not applied to the facts in those cases. When we've actually applied the the irrespective test to the facts, I think that we have had that those approaches in the Hilliard, Cooley, and others support the approach that's being taken in Draft B, and it's for that reason that I'm supporting Draft B.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to prolong this needlessly, but I actually think that's not entirely right. I think there have been instances in more recent years when we have said you can't use campaign funds to cover certain legal expenses because they're not closely enough related to office holder and campaign activities.
If I could jump in. Where to begin? Much of what Commissioner Weintraub said is absolutely correct. If someone has to pay for a lawyer because they have a personal property dispute because they're a landlord, they can't use campaign funds for that, even though the newspapers show up and want to cover it necessarily. They get in a messy divorce, it's probably the same. If they're a criminal defendant in a drunk driving case, I don't think the commission allows use of campaign funds for that. However, that's not the case that we have here before us. This is not a situation where the requester was a defendant or a party to a civil suit. He was a witness, and a witness that was and the reason why he was a witness is because of, I think, a very compelling set of facts presented by the requester, that the person who was the defendant in the case certainly had a strategy of pulling in high-profile people to try to get headlines. It certainly occurred. There's a volume of news articles which muddy the facts even further as to what was really happening, as to how many people were actually subpoenaed and that kind of thing. I don't think any of those factual distinctions are material for the real question before the commission. But I think that really the case couldn't be more compelling. If it were a case of first impression, however, I think that As always, the vice chair's comments are thoughtful, well-reasoned, and are also wholly consistent with the statutory text as written. But this is not a case of first impression. The commission has had many years and many advisory opinions on this matter, and I believe that draft B is wholly consistent with the commission's past rulings. And in fact, the commission's past rulings really lead to only one result, and that is the result in draft B. Draft B cites the Cooley AO from 1996, which states, quote, "The commission recognized that the activities of candidates and office holders may receive heightened scrutiny and attention because of their status as candidates and office holders. The obvious need for a candidate to respond to allegations that result from this elevated scrutiny would not exist irrespective of the candidate's campaign or office holder status." I'm very hesitant to essentially undo what the commission has already done. After all, advisory opinions are one of the few ways folks can get guidance from the commission and then rely upon it. The statute is clear on this point. Once an advisory opinion is issued, that requester can rely on it, and anyone who operates under that advisory opinion and on factual matters indistinguishable in any sort of material respect can rely upon that AO. The alternative, the draft A, however, overrules, as I read it, past commission advisory opinions. And that's very troubling because I think people have probably relied on those advisory opinions, and I see that the request currently before us obviously is headed the same direction, particularly with respect to the idea of monitoring a criminal proceeding. Looking at draft A, page 12 at the top there, it explicitly says, "Thus, this advisory opinion supersedes in part advisory opinion 9712, Costello, to the extent the opinion permitted the use of campaign funds to pay for a portion of legal expenses resulting from monitoring a third party's criminal trial." So to get to the result that draft A gets requires undoing what has already been done, and that's something I'm hesitant to do. Again, these are very tough questions. It seems to me somewhat counterintuitive that one could pay a lawyer to defend one from an accusation of bribery, but not necessarily use campaign funds to pay for a situation where they're a witness in a trial. So for that reason, I support draft B. Senator Vitter himself actually submitted a comment personally. He did not do it through counsel, and very rare. And he really presents to me a very thoughtful approach. I disagree with one thing he does say at the end, though, where he says a tied vote will mean a complete lack of resolution in this case. I don't think it does. I think there's quite a bit of agreement on certain issues here. It's just a couple other issues where there's going to be disagreement. But in the case of a deadlock, the advisory opinions that are currently on the books would govern. So to the extent Senator Vitter can avail himself of the protections of those advisory opinions, there is guidance, and this would not result in him not having guidance. He could then use whatever advisory opinions still would be good law for comfort. And the statute mandates that result, so that we're clear what the statute says in that respect. Any person involved in any specific transaction or activity which is indistinguishable in all its material aspects — materiality is a very important concept — our material aspects from the transaction or activity with respect to which his advisory opinion is rendered, may rely on this advisory opinion. This is it. This is in the statute, and that is what's in all advisory opinions now. And the site is 2 U.S.C. 437F C1B for those who are into sites. So to the extent someone is reviewing this after the fact, reads the transcript or whatnot, there shouldn't be any confusion as to what a deadlock may mean. It means whatever the current advisory opinion situation is remains the law of at least this commission and perhaps the law of the land. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be interested to see. We haven't been working together that long. I'll be interested to see as we go forward if you maintain your attitude towards existing advisory opinions and how we must maintain them and not change anything that the commission has said in years gone by. I would just point out that the
obviously if there's a statutory change, that would change an advisory opinion. Facts can change, and advisory opinions are conceivably fact intensive. So it's certainly not a situation where it's a mechanical application of the law. But once an advisory opinion is rendered, I think it does have some effect, and I don't think we should willy nilly disregard them to get to a certain result. And I think draft A does that.
Well, I take some exception to that characterization that anyone is trying to approach anything with a goal of getting to a certain result. Just as I take some exception to the characterization that, you know, we're motivated because we think an individual is engaged in bad acts. We're applying the law here. And the commission has, in more recent advisory opinions, diverged from the viewpoint of those older advisory opinions. So I think that the law on the books is considerably muddier than you've suggested. And I think that's why Mr. Vitter's excellent attorney submitted this advisory opinion request, because he didn't think it was absolutely clear. I noted that when we received the request, that he didn't ask whether he could use whether the senator could use campaign funds in order to pay someone who is exclusively working on the ethics investigation. And I believe that's because that is undisputed, and the commission has never said anything to the contrary, and the question really didn't need to be asked. I don't want to speak for anybody who's sitting in the audience, but that was my assumption as to why that piece of it was not made part of the advisory opinion request. I do think that the interpretation of preceding precedents to the facts at issue, the specific facts at issue in Senator Vitter's request, are not nearly as clear-cut as you've suggested.
Do you agree, though, that draft A does supersede at least one past AO in some form?
In some form, but I believe that the more recent advisory opinions have already gone down that road.
Fair enough. My thought of why they asked, though, wasn't because they were uncertain as to the result. The reality is, I think the House Ethics Committee requires, and the Senate Committee certainly does, pre-approval for use of campaign funds for such things. So I think they do have to come in. I don't think it's necessarily because the law was unclear. I think they came in because, for their own ethical obligations as a member of the Senate, they had to submit an opinion and see if they can get specific guidance to their situation. And my point is they are going to get some specific guidance on certain issues. Other issues they're not, and I'm suggesting under the statute they can then rely upon prior advisory opinions.
And I'm suggesting that reliance might be a bit risky.
That's why we have an advisory opinion process, so people can protect themselves in factual situations. It's a shield to protect people who are willing to come in and ask for advice, and the commission ought to see it as such.
And we do when we have four votes for an opinion. It works.
Well, but we don't need four votes to protect. Once the opinion's rendered, we don't need four votes to then keep it in place and protect that particular situation.
Well, this particular situation has not been presented to the commission before.
I disagree. Do we have a motion? Unless there are other comments. We have other comments? Sorry.
I'm ready to.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
With respect to advisory opinion 2008-07, I move that we adopt draft B.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Nay.
Motion fails 3-3 with Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, and McGann voting in favor, Commissioners Walther, Bowerly, and Weintraub voting in opposition. Any other motions? Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the adoption of agenda document 0820, which is referred to as draft A.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. That motion fails 3-3. What I would, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we instruct counsel to prepare a document that would approve those for which we've indicated we have approval, namely the press relations and consultation, but that would point out that we were unable to give guidance on the issue of quashing subpoenas and monitoring, and to prepare that for our signature.
Does council have any questions on that motion?
One question, in preparing it for your signature, meaning you would not want to have it come around as a tally vote or anything. We would just drop out certain portions of it where there is not agreement, or would you want to see it again as a tally vote document? We can happily do it either way.
I would think tally vote, because there's areas of agreement, and we get those through, and then sooner the better, I would think. So we do tally vote and
okay.
Take a look at it that way. Does that work for the council?
Yes.
Wonderful. Next item on the agenda.
Wait a minute. Don't we need to vote on that?
We vote on, we didn't vote on the motion. Sorry, I apologize. We didn't vote on the motion. I asked for the question before the vote this time. Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub.
We do want to give him the guidance that we can give.
Yeah, we do. That would be nice after all this, and then, you know, we forget to actually do anything. I apologize for that. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? 6-0. The motion passes. Next item on the agenda is a advisory opinion request from Senator Lautenberg. And presenting from the council is Joanna Waldsteiger, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We also have Allison Steinle and Johnny Levin working on it. I think others, Johnny, yes.
Agenda document 08-18 responds to an advisory opinion request submitted by counsel for Senator Frank Lautenberg and his principal campaign committee, Lautenberg for Senate. Senator Lautenberg loaned his campaign committee a total of $1.6 million toward his June 3, 2008 primary election. According to reports filed with the commission, these loans have not been repaid. On June 26, the Supreme Court issued its opinion in Davis v. Federal Election Commission, striking down two provisions of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act as unconstitutional. These provisions concerned increased contribution and party spending limits and related disclosure requirements. Senator Lautenberg and his campaign committee ask whether, in light of the Davis decision, the commission will enforce against them the provision of BCRA placing certain limits on an authorized committee's repayment of a personal loan from the candidate. The draft before you concludes that the loan repayment provision was not addressed in Davis and that it is severable from the provisions that were struck down. Therefore, Senator Lautenberg and his campaign committee remain subject to the provision. We received one comment on the advisory opinion request. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Comments? It is what it is, huh? Then I'll just say a few words to put a little context on this. It's an interesting request because it does make sense to make the request post FEC versus Davis, which struck down the millionaire provision. The court, however, there did not rule on this particular question regarding a candidate's ability to self-finance and whether or not that money would be considered a loan or a contribution, and ultimately whether it can be paid back to the candidate. The Supreme Court in McConnell upheld it on its face, and the Supreme Court has not addressed the issue since, nor has any other federal court. And thus, I feel that we are bound, as we should be bound, by the statute. We did receive one comment from Campaign Legal Center and Democracy 21. I thought they were very helpful, and I thought they were right on the money with the need to read the statute as is and not essentially do a backdoor constitutional challenge. Regardless of what one may think of the constitutionality, this is not the format for that. The requester did make an interesting argument that did cause me some pause, which is the way the law was passed out of the Senate and House was a little bit different than how it was codified in the book. It was much more compressed into one section. However, I think the law is somewhat clear that we as an agency can still sever out the portion that remains. There is a severability clause that was in the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act that was actually something subject to vigorous debate in the House for probably precisely these situations where a portion would be maybe perhaps struck down, but then the rest would still live on. So in my view, it does live on. I do want to note that this is a very quick request that has come through. I asked the council, do we recall when this was actually submitted? It was early August, late July.
I believe it was July 25th.
July 25th. I think it made it upstairs maybe the first week of August, and here we are a few weeks later, and that really is a tribute to in reverse order, really, my fellow commissioners. I really appreciate them indulging me and trying to move things through quickly. But actually, this was one that I think others came to me and said, can we move this through quickly, particularly the vice chair, Commissioner Bowerly and Commissioner Weintraub, seeing if I would be interested in moving this sort of request quickly. And we are. And I really want to thank the staff on this. The council's office really went beyond the call of duty to circulate a very quick draft. And we really appreciate you willing to indulge us in what has been a very tough time for you, I'm sure, because many things have changed. The commission was shut down for 6 months, essentially, and did what it could. But given that you need four votes and at least four voting commissioners to even have a meeting, not much occurred. And we just really want to thank you for moving this along. I think it's important to get people real advice in real time. So with that overblown speech, is there a motion on the one draft that we have in front of us?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we adopt the draft before us, draft AO 2008-07. Oops, sorry about that. 2008-09, pardon me.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. I'd like to take a 5-minute recess.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion.
All right, hang on.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move for the suspension of the rules for the timely submission of documents to consider agenda document 0817B and 0817C.
Without objection, so ordered. Take it away.
Thank you. Good morning. Danita Lee on behalf of the Office of General Counsel. Pending before the Commission is Senator John McCain's request of February 8, 2008 to withdraw from the Presidential Primary Matching Payment Program. The Commission was previously unable to act on this request because it lacked a quorum. Also before the Commission is the Office of General Counsel's memorandum analyzing various issues arising from the request to withdraw and recommending that the Commission release Senator McCain from his obligations under the Matching Payment Program. As background, last August, Senator McCain applied to participate in the matching payment program, and on August 28, 2007, the commission certified that Senator McCain was entitled to $100,000 in matching payment program funds. On December 19, 2007, the commission certified that Senator McCain was entitled to an additional amount in excess of $5.9 million. We understand that the U.S. Department of Treasury has not paid matching payment program funds to Senator McCain pursuant to notice it received from Senator McCain regarding withdrawal. We also understand that the Treasury has delayed making payments because it is awaiting action from the Commission as to whether it will withdraw its certifications entitling Senator McCain to matching funds. The Office of General Counsel recommends that Senator McCain be released from the matching payment program because, as discussed in our memo, the public financing program involves providing money as a public benefit to a candidate in exchange for his agreement to be voluntarily bound by the expenditure limits. We conclude, therefore, that there necessarily exists a point of no return after which a candidate has received or is at least assured of receiving the public benefit such that he is bound by the spending limits. We further conclude that the point of no return is either the actual receipt of public funds or pledging public funds as security for private financing, and that the pledge of public funds as security for financing constitutes receipt or the benefit of the bargain. In our memo, we offer three different approaches for considering the request to withdraw. In support of our recommendation, we look to the Commission's bridge and bank loan regulations, which deal with the use of entitlement to public funds as security for private loans, for guidance on the Commission's intended meaning of the pledged standard as put forth in the Dean withdrawal matter and the Gephardt advisory opinion. We also examine the alternative approaches which would either prohibit withdrawal or permit withdrawal under a different standard. Regarding our recommended approach, under the bridge and bank loan regulatory standards as applied here, we believe that no unambiguous pledge of public funds occurred and that no public funds were made available to the bank to retire the loan. Therefore, Senator McCain did not receive the benefit of the bargain. Also, in support of our recommendation, we indicated that we had not identified any persuasive policy reasons to prohibit withdrawal. We balanced the consideration of money as the public benefit against taking an inflexible approach that would bind candidates who do not want the money, and note that unwanted funds could then be dispersed among other publicly financed candidates who actually wanted to be in the program. We considered that taking an inflexible approach could discourage participation and think that there exists low potential for abuse for candidates abusing the ancillary benefits of the program. Regarding the two alternative approaches, we discuss underlying legal authority, associated pros and cons that the Commission may wish to consider in determining whether to release Senator McCain from the matching payment program. The first alternative addresses a plain language interpretation of the Matching Payment Act. This interpretation would prohibit withdrawal and conclude that the Commission does not have any discretion on the issue. The second alternative considers that withdrawal is permissible, but concludes that the Gephardt advisory opinion is non-binding and establishes the point of no return as the date the candidate receives public funding payments. Our Associate General Counsel, Lawrence Calvert, will expand on these alternatives in just a moment. Finally, we provided the Commission with a supplemental memorandum on our conclusion that an affirmative vote of four commissioners is required to release Senator McCain from the matching payment program. We stated that four votes are required for entry into the program, and that absent legal authority for any person or entity to effect the determination, four commissioner votes are necessary to authorize reversal of eligibility status. We also note that a candidate cannot unilaterally determine that the regulatory requirements of the program are not binding, and that if withdrawal standards are going to apply, the Commission must evaluate and determine whether the standards have been met. Mr. Calvert.
Thank you, Ms. Lee, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. We wanted to expand a little bit and sort of walk you through the rationales for the three potential outcomes that we've presented in our memo. The first outcome would say, as Ms. Lee indicated, outcome one in our memo is one of the two outcomes that we're not recommending. And it would say that not only may Senator McCain not withdraw, but nobody may withdraw. And it is based in a close reading of the text of both FICA and the Matching Payment Act. FECA provides that any candidate who is determined to be eligible for matching funds shall be subject to spending limits. And conversely, it binds the government by providing that a candidate who that the commission shall certify a candidate who is eligible as entitled to payment of particular amounts, and that the Treasury shall promptly pay those amounts once certified. In this reading would note that there's an awful lot of mandatory language there. The candidate shall be bound to the limits. The government is bound. We shall certify. The Treasury shall pay. And that there's no indication in all of that mandatory language of any discretion to do anything other than what the statute says. And if you were to read that very restrictively and very in a very textualist manner, you could come to the conclusion that withdrawal isn't permitted by the statute, that once a candidate is determined to be eligible, that that certain things happen and they are bound to happen and that they can't be reversed. Alternatively, the commission could as well determine that, well, no, there is nothing in the statute that specifically says in as many words that you can't withdraw. The commission has in the past permitted candidates to withdraw from the matching payment program, and the statutory silence, according to familiar principles of administrative law like the Supreme Court's Chevron decision, and even cases that we have been a party to, such as the D.C. Circuit's Kennedy decision in 1984, would say that that's a statutory silence that the commission, that it is the commission's job to fill, so long as its interpretation of the statute isn't arbitrary or capricious or contrary to the terms of the statute. So that would lead you to a conclusion, as the commission has concluded in three prior matters, the Dole, Dean, and Gephardt matters, that candidates can withdraw. Saying that a candidate can withdraw, though, is not the same as saying exactly where the point of no return that Ms. Lee alluded to is. We do think that there is a point of no return inherent in the matching funds system whereby the candidate has received the benefit of the constitutional bargain in which they give up their right to speak freely in exchange for a public benefit, or to speak without limit in exchange for a public benefit. If you believe that candidates can withdraw, there are two potential places that we've identified where that point of no return might be. The Gephardt opinion in 2003 contains language that indicates that the point of no return is when a candidate has pledged public funds as security for private financing. But what you could conclude is that in point of fact, that the point of no return really is just when the public funds actually are distributed to the candidate, and you could get there this way. The Gephardt opinion, you could read the phrase about pledging public funds as security for private financing in the Gephardt opinion, not as setting a binding condition precedent, for after all, under 437FC, the commission can't use the AO process to make generally binding rules of law. You could say that it was simply a material fact that was material to Congressman Gephardt's request and that of his committee. The Gephardt committee had not pledged public funds as security for private financing. And so you could read that as simply saying that any candidate who presented the same facts would be able to rely, and who presented materially indistinguishable facts would be able to rely on that opinion. And that the commission had in Gephardt left for another day the question of what happens if a candidate does pledge public funds as security for private financing. You could then say, if you reached the conclusion that, that the point of no return is a little on, further on down the road, that you know what, even if you just assumed for the sake of the argument that Senator McCain had pledged public funds for private financing, you'd thought about it, and actually you now determine that the point of no return for everybody is when the funds are actually paid out from the Treasury. And that would be a permissible interpretation of the statute as well, but it's not also not the one that we recommend. What we recommend is that you conclude, much as the Gephardt advisory opinion appeared to do, that in fact the point of no return is either if you don't pledge any funds as security for private financing, it's when you get the Treasury money, or it's if you do, it's when you pledge public funds as security for private financing. That raises a question, though, as to what the Commission meant in the Gephardt opinion when it used that phrase, pledged public funds as security for private finance. The Gephardt opinion does not say what the Commission meant by that phrase, and there are a number of things it could possibly mean. We concluded that the best place to look for what the Commission might have meant by that phrase was other areas of the Commission's own body of law in which it's used the similar phrasing and dealt with similar concepts. And in the Commission's regulations, there are really two places where it has dealt with similar concepts. There is the, in the public financing regulations, there is the bridge loan provision, which says that during a period of a shortfall in the matching payment fund, we will not count as expenditures interest payments to the bank where the candidate just goes to a bank and gets a short-term bridge loan to tide them over until the shortfall can be made whole by the Treasury. And there are also the regulations that are applicable not just in the public financing program, but the generally applicable regulations in 11 CFR 100.82 dealing with when loans are adequately collateralized. Those provisions at 100.82 have a five-part test for when a loan is adequately collateralized, two of which mention public funds, one of which actually applies only to public financing. 100.82 inquires whether the loan agreement required the public financing payments or other future receipts pledged as collateral to be deposited into a separate depository account for the purposes of retiring the bank loan debt. And in the public financing context, they inquire whether the borrower authorized the Secretary of the Treasury to directly deposit the payments into the depository account for the purpose of retiring the debt. So looking at those scenarios, we concluded that what the Commission meant when it used the phrase pledged public funds as security for private financing was basically pretty narrow, that it was talking about situations in which a committee that is approved for public funds but hasn't received them yet, whether because of a shortfall or because it's the latter part of the calendar year before the election, goes to the bank and says, I'm supposed to get so much money in public funds, give me this amount and you'll get it back. What well, the two elements are of that are really sort of a lack of any ambiguity at all that the pledge, that the public funds are pledged as collateral for private financing, and provision for the public funds when they are available to be made to very rapidly find themselves in the hands of the lender in satisfaction of the debt. Applying those standards to Senator McCain's situation, this is what we came up with. The loan agreement contained basically two provisions that are potentially relevant. The original loan agreement provided first, that any certifications of matching fund eligibility, including related rights currently possessed by the McCain Committee, were obtained before January 1, 2008, are not themselves being pledged as security for the indebtedness and are not themselves collateral. The agreement was later modified to drop the January 1st reference. Reading eligibility as meaning eligibility and meaning all of this reading, which would mean that all of the certifications of entitlement to particular amounts that came out of that eligibility would be related rights to the eligibility. We read that as saying that on Senator McCain's initial eligibility, public funds are not pledged as security for private financing. There was also a provision in the loan agreement, that in the memo, that we have called the in-out-in provision. And under this provision, if Senator McCain determined to withdraw from the matching payment program, and if he then did poorly at the polls, according to specified percentages that were set forth in the loan agreement, he would then reapply for another eligibility into the public financing program. He would have pledged, of course, to remain a candidate to make that possible, and that he then promised to give the bank a first perfected security interest in any such funds to which he was eligible if that set of contingencies ever came to pass. The way we looked at the in-out-in provision was basically this. First of all, there's sort of a problem with, even before you apply the loan analysis to it, there's sort of this problem: the commission cannot withdraw or refuse to withdraw a hypothetical second eligibility that might or might not occur, that it hasn't granted yet, and that in fact did not occur, and that it never granted. The other thing about that is that you can say that that's an unambiguous pledge of public funds as collateral only upon the occurrence of a series of contingencies of which the hypothetical second eligibility is no sooner than third. It would actually be more accurate to say that the in-out-in provision didn't pledge any public funds at all, at least at the time of the agreement, because at the time there was no such eligibility. There also was still no provision, whether under the in-out-in provision or not, in this loan agreement that made it clear that that the public funds were going to go immediately to the Treasury. And indeed, it's our understanding that Senator McCain never did and never yet has provided the Treasury with any information about where to deliver the public funds, either by wire transfer or elsewhere. So running through that analysis, we concluded ultimately that Senator McCain, we conclude that the commission should, first of all, we recommend that the commission adopt the outcome three legal framework because it has the closest fit to the basic concept of ensuring that the bargain is public funds in exchange for spending limits while still covering the bridge and bank loan situations as essentially a constructive receipt of public funds. And then applying that analysis, we concluded that Senator McCain did not, under that definition, pledge public funds as security for private financing, and that we recommend that you withdraw his certifications to the Treasury. And I apologize for the length of that presentation, but it was a fairly detailed analysis, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you have about that or anything else.
Actually, everyone's quick. The ultimate recommendation is withdraw the certification.
Yes.
Okay.
And approve attached letters to the Treasury,
which would require a vote to
do that,
because that would go to the Department of Treasury, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just so we're clear on what the actual recommendation is. Thoughts, comments, questions? The floor is open. Do we have a motion on the recommendation? Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bowerly.
At the outset, I'd like to address questions raised about whether the commission can act at all upon Senator McCain's letter, which states that it's a notice rather than a request. The commission has, on at least two other occasions, treated such notices as withdrawal requests. And in addition, in this matter in particular, then-Chairman Mason on February 19th informed Senator McCain through his counsel that the commission would treat this notice as a request. And that's what remains pending before us today, I believe. In addition, it's my view that the commission has authority to treat this letter as a request because the alternative is not, in my view, contemplated by the statute. As the council mentioned, it seems that there must be a point of no return under the system in order to protect its integrity, and that's what the commission decided essentially in the Gebhardt AO. This would become meaningless if candidates would be able to unilaterally withdraw after receiving money. So as we're contemplating this question of how to deal with this request, for me the question is what factors should we consider when a candidate presents such a request to us to withdraw from this program. It is a voluntary program, and I think that's both mandated by the Constitution and a very important beneficial aspect of the program. So we should make this program as attractive to candidates to use, because that's the purpose of the statute, is to provide this public funding, and I personally think that's a good idea, and I think as the commission is charged with enforcing and implementing the law, that's our obligation. It's my view in the Gebhardt AO, AO 2335, the commission addressed fairly similar facts and determined that it would permit a candidate to withdraw so long as the candidate had not received matching payment program funds and had not pledged the certification of matching funds as security for private financing. And as the council has said, that phrase is not defined in that AO, so it does require some analysis in my view. In this case, we're told by the bank's lawyers that the loan terms were carefully drafted to exclude from the bank's collateral any matching fund certification, retaining the flexibility to withdraw from the matching fund program as set out by under the authority of Gebhardt. So even Senator McCain's lawyers believe that Gebhardt could preclude granting a request for withdrawal once public funds had been received or had been pledged as security. The question here is whether Senator McCain pledged those public funds as security for the loan, and the loan documents themselves are, shall we say, slightly murky on this in my view. In the space for collateral in the loan document, which was originally executed on November 11th, 2007, it specifically excludes as collateral any certifications for matching fund eligibility currently possessed by the borrower obtained before January 1st. And at this point in time, Senator McCain had been declared eligible for matching funds in the amount of approximately $700,000. The contract further requires McCain to remain a candidate and states that in the event that he were to withdraw from the matching fund program but lost in New Hampshire, he would reapply for those matching funds and grant it to the bank as a first priority perfected security interest. On its face, it appears to me that the bank's lawyers may have been successful in drafting a loan agreement that did not pledge public funding as a security for the loan, but instead only included a conditional future promise to stay in the matching system. On December 17th, a modification was made to the loan document, however, and this happened 2 days before the commission certified Senator McCain for over $5.5 million in public funds. That modification, the loan documents were amended to redefine collateral as excluding only any certification of matching funds eligibility now held by the borrower and or John McCain. In other words, as I read it, under the new terms of the loan modification, collateral for the loan could be read to include any certification for matching funds received after December 17th, including that $5.5 million in public funds for which he was certified on December 19th. For me, this raises the question of whether these sets of documents fit squarely within Gebhardt's view of pledging public funding as security for the loan. Absent viewing public funding as collateral for the loan, it is difficult for me to see what collateral might have been pledged for this loan. And as the council has stated, we have a regulation which sets forth some specific requirements for what a loan must look like. So in my view, there are two ways to read this loan document. Either there is collateral in the form of the matching payment system, the payments for which Senator McCain would receive under that system, or that the terms of the loan may not be sufficient to ensure repayment as required under our regs, and thus may raise different issues. The question before us is whether Senator McCain should be permitted to withdraw. I think it's a close call for me, and I think that, frankly, the creative drafting of these documents are both confusing and perhaps troubling from my perspective, but I conclude that they are future promises to stay in the matching program and thus not sufficient to meet the pledge to security requirements of Gephardt. And thus, having neither received public funds nor pledged them as security, the McCain Committee should be permitted to withdraw from the program.
Other comments? Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For me, there's a basic threshold question that I need to get resolved before I can get to the next question of whether Senator McCain's certification should be withdrawn by the commission. And that is whether that is our decision to make. It's been contested that it isn't, that all the senator had to do was send us a letter and say, I'm out, bye-bye, and we have nothing to say about it. And I strongly disagree with that position. I sat down with former Chairman Mason in February with our council, and we thought long and hard about what we should do with that letter when we received it. I thought it was an example of the best that this commission can be in its functioning, in that it was a totally bipartisan, in a sense it was in a nonpartisan decision. We sat there together and thought about the law and discussed the law and researched the law and asked for counsel on the law, and it was not made with a view toward achieving a particular result for a particular candidate, or in mind of the party affiliation of that candidate, or whether we liked the candidate or would want to vote for the candidate. It was a purely legal question. Being evenly split, this commission really can't function unless people are willing to come together and talk that way and work across party lines. And Commissioner Mason was always willing to do that, and I appreciated that about him. And he appears to have suffered some consequences from that decision on his part to work in that fashion, because his nomination to continue to serve on the commission was subsequently withdrawn by the president. But we came to this conclusion together, although he signed it, as the chairman almost always signs the correspondence of the commission, that indeed the commission did have that role, that members of the regulated community cannot decide for themselves. No matter who they are, excuse me, they do not have the prerogative to decide for themselves when they're in compliance with the law and when they're not in compliance with the law, and what the law means and what it doesn't mean. That is ultimately the role of the commission, and if people don't like it, they can sue us over it, and then ultimately it gets resolved by the courts. It's been known to happen. But I feel very strongly that we need to preserve our prerogative as an administrative agency, as an enforcement agency, to be the arbiter of the law, and not just to accept the views of the regulated community on what they think the law ought to be. So for me, this is a really important threshold question, and I completely agree that the only way to get out is to have four votes, and that was our dilemma at the time, is we didn't have four votes to give him if we wanted to. We only had two votes. So here we stand a number of months later, and finally, I think everyone's pleased that we have a commission that's got six members. But it would be very unfortunate, in my view, if we waited all that time to get a fully functioning commission, only to have the commission turn around and, as one of its first official acts, start ceding its authority to the regulated community. So before I can even reach the question of whether it would be appropriate for the commission to determine that Senator McCain can withdraw from the public financing system, I really need to know whether we have that consensus here today, whether this commission believes that it has that authority to make that decision, because I do. And if there's not that consensus, then I probably am not going to be able to support any subsequent result that comes afterwards.
Mr. Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Weintraub, I don't believe that that question is before us today, so I think we're all certainly willing to have that debate, and you bring up some good points. But the question before us today, as the chairman just asked the council, is whether or not we vote on the recommendation to send the letters to withdraw the certification to the Secretary of Treasury, and to approve the attached letters to counsel for Senator McCain. So I don't know that that's necessarily something that we have to hit squarely. If it is covered by this, then I think I, speaking for myself, am willing to make that vote, that we have to do that in this case to send those letters to tell the Secretary of Treasury not to give him any funds. I think this case raises a lot of interesting issues, as you mentioned. For one thing, when the senator originally sent his letter, as many of us have noted, there was no working commission. And the commission does need 4 votes to act, which is why it was literally impossible for the commission to vote or not vote. So it was not an issue that was even before the commission at the time, because there wasn't one. And also, I think Senator McCain's campaign probably had a lot to rely on in their decision to send a letter just notifying the commission of its withdrawal. First of all, there was no commission, and second of all, Regulation 9035.2D, which states the expenditure limitations of 11 CFR 9035.1 shall not apply to a candidate who does not receive matching funds at any time during the matching payment period. And clearly, I don't think the fact that the senator did not receive any funds is not debatable at this point. He did not receive any funds. So those two factors put together, and also, as Commissioner Bowerly suggested, there are several advisory opinions on point here. So I think the senator had enough cover to say, I'm hereby withdrawing. One other point in this matter is that I think we all can agree that campaigns must know the rules of the game in order to complete their campaign strategy. And to the extent that commission rules aren't clear, as we've learned today, people can submit advisory opinion requests, as Senator Barack Obama did in 2007 when he was preparing for a possible candidacy. In his request, he noted that, quote, without a clear determination from the agency, the senator cannot complete planning for his campaign. The FEC subsequently issued a clear opinion granting his request to raise general election funds while he was a primary candidate, but preserve his right to accept public funding in the general election. And again, the point is that people need clear rules in order to run their campaigns, and I think that there was precedent here for the senator to write his letter in that way. And in this case, I am prepared to vote on the recommendations before us. Thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to address the issue of jurisdiction or discretion, because I struggled with the same issue myself, because I noted that in two of the times before which we dealt with the issue, both with respect to the Dole matter and the Governor Dean, when they withdrew, in each instance they gave notice that they were withdrawing, and we chose to call it a request. And then with respect to the advisory opinion in Gephardt, that's different. They asked for an advisory opinion, we gave an advisory opinion. So the only two times when there was actually a withdrawal, and Gephardt did not withdraw, the only two times when there actually was a withdrawal issue, they gave notice of withdrawal, just like Senator McCain did. And so did we create the situation by calling it a request or not? And I have to admit, in my conversations with a number of commissioners, I was struggling with the idea of, well, do we have anything more than a ministerial act? Once a letter is sent, I'm out. And clearly there's no money in that particular case. Do we have any discretion? And I thought probably we do not. So, but in the process of thinking about it, there are a number of times when, first of all, we have to administer the law with respect to public funding. And we also have to provide the Treasury Department with a certificate of eligibility to participate. Whenever we do that, it seems to me we have an ongoing relationship, regardless of the candidate. I don't mean that in a negative way or in a minor way, to work with the Department of Treasury in administering the system. In this particular case, and in others, when we issue that certification, as we did initially, of eligibility, and then we told the Treasury in a subsequent certification first of all, I'll go back. When he issued the original certificate of eligibility, automatically that means an eligibility for $100,000. Subsequently, there was a submission by the senator for over $5 million, I think $5.9 million, something like that, $5.8 million, which would, that gets you up to the $6 million mark. We authorized Treasury to pay that money to Senator McCain. Then a letter comes out from his campaign saying that he has withdrawn. Now, statutorily, Treasury must abide by whatever we tell them to do in connection with that process. They don't decide how the money is going to be spent. They just decide to comply with our certification. So regardless of the other issues, which I'm not saying are minor, I think we have an absolute duty to communicate and exercise our discretion as to when and when not Treasury is obligated to spend money on the campaign. We are aware that Treasury has awaited to hear from us on this issue, and they have been in a somewhat of a paralyzed state because they are aware of the letter, they are aware of the claim that there's no desire to receive the money. On the other hand, the commission has remained silent. And I'm glad we're not. I have to be one of the ones that was without a paycheck for 6 months, and I'm glad to be back for that and other reasons. But everybody was in a period of paralysis. So I think Treasury, that relationship alone is an important factor in determining to what extent we have discretion here. And I think we have to exercise it. I think the question is, sometimes our discretion may be fairly limited by the facts. And I think a commissioner pointed out the one regulation that is of interest to me, because I think it's, of all the regulations, of which we have almost none here on this issue, and the statute does not tell us, give us guidance on when a person can withdraw or when they cannot, or if they can or if they cannot once they get certified. Likewise, the regulations don't speak to that either. And I think we need to regulate in the area, because I think candidates are left in somewhat of a no person's land when they get into situations like this, and there's a lot at stake. Certainly it was for the senator. Some action on our part could certainly have been given if we were in commission, so to speak, and very early on in February. If there was a disagreement with our decision, they could certainly take that up for a judicial decision on whether or not we were correct. But that was foreclosed by the events that occurred. But the one regulation that to me is important to keep in mind is one that we've adopted. It says the expenditure limitations of 11 CFR 90351 shall not apply to a candidate who does not receive matching funds at any time during the matching payment period. Essentially saying, if you don't receive the money, you don't have the limits. That's our law. So when I look at that, it seems clear to me that we have discretion and we must exercise it within the confines of what the law says. In this particular case, it's complicated because we issued an advisory opinion in the Gephardt matter in which a phrase was included that he was allowed to withdraw, I'm not sure if it said so long as, but in view of the fact that there was no pledging of public funds of security for private financing. In that particular AO, advisory opinion, there was none. So the issue never really presented itself on the merits to the commission as what we do if there was. This is really a case of first impression if we were to find that there was a pledging. And I would also add that to elevate that phrase in this case without any definition or public input regarding the meaning of those words would be, to me, beyond what would be appropriate here. Now, I recognize that the Office of General Counsel suggests that it has specific meaning, but on the other hand, it's not clear if that is so or not. And furthermore, an advisory opinion, as most all of you here are aware, is not the law. It's our opinion on the law. And sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong, but an advisory opinion provides someone who asks for it a shield from prosecution civilly or criminally if they comport with our advice. We can only make the law and make it enforceable as law for all unless we adopt a procedure to adopt rules, which we've not done, other than the one I just read to you. That means you get public comment. We have to issue explanation and justification so that the rule is clear as to what we're adopting and why, and we've had the benefit of public input. on that. None of that has occurred in this case with respect to that requirement. I'm not saying it's unreasonable. In fact, I think there are times when it would make a lot of sense. But I think for us to blindly say this is applicable is beyond what I think is reasonable in this particular case. I also would agree with the comments of the commissioners so far that have dealt with the subject that in looking at the transaction itself, the question is, did you pledge public funds as security for private financing? That's the phrase. The loan documents had two potential ways to do this, or two potential opportunities. One, by the certificate that was already issued to the senator. In that particular one, the one certificate of eligibility which was actually issued, there was only one, the loan documents made clear that it was exempt. Now, there can be a lot of conversation about that, but nevertheless, the loan documents are completely clear on that, and counsel for the senator indicated they were quite aware of that provision, and regardless of whether or not they thought it was law or not, they did not want to be subject to a claim of violation for not adhering to that phrase. And so there was no way under the documents that I read them that the bank could have enforced a first priority interest in any money coming out at that particular time. In fact, the loan documents anticipated that the senator on his own could withdraw and foreclose that particular asset, if you want to call it that, at any time. And ultimately, of course, the senator did with no problem on the part of the bank. The second opportunity for pledging would be any certificate to be issued in the future. The loan documents did contemplate that if the senator did poorly, and that was specified to a certain degree of distance between the winner and not in either the caucuses or the primaries occurring after his withdrawal, that he would within 30 days, as I recall, apply for matching funds, and if that were accepted and if that were issued, then they would have a first priority perfected interest. As I understand it, the only way you can perfect an interest in a security certificate at this time that's been done in the past is to actually give Treasury instructions to issue those funds to the account of the lender, at which time that is the perfected way in order to assure that the money goes to the lender. And neither with respect to the first or of course the second was that done. I think the Office of General Counsel is quite correct in their analysis that you couldn't have a pledge of security interest for something that's non-existent. As to the first, there clearly was not one, and as to the second, it was not ever one that came into existence. So in looking at the loan documents, regardless of the law with respect to hypothecation, I think there was no such pledge. So for those reasons, I'm willing to support the recommendation of the General Counsel.
May I ask a question of clarification that I think may go to Commissioner Weintraub's concern, which I also share. As I mentioned, I do believe this is an action that requires the discretion of the commission. As the vice chairman said, it may require consideration of a fairly limited set of factors. It's my understanding that we were going to be substituting agenda document 817C for the letters in the council's recommendation.
Not to talk about myself in the third person, but in the opinion of the chair, I think that's right. I think the vice chair, his support of the recommendation is as amended by the blue draft.
Okay, well,
I believe. Now, the vice chair can speak for himself, but I believe that's where we are.
I'll just finish up with my understanding of what that means. In particular, that's important to me, and I raise that question because on the second page of that document, it's a letter to Mr. Potter as general counsel for John McCain 2008 that says responding to this request requires the exercise of the discretion of the commission. And to me that is an important factor. As I stated earlier, I believe that is a decision that this commission must make. It's well within our authority, and in my view, the alternative view that a candidate could simply voluntarily get in and out at will undermines the integrity of the whole system.
Kind of on the first round. See if we have anyone. No. Mr. Weintraub.
I didn't have anything to say.
We're being educated, I think.
I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I thank Commissioner Bowerly for pointing out that language in the letters, because I was looking at the wrong side of the piece of paper, and I thought that concept was in there somewhere, but I'm
trying to save paper by doing two-sided.
I think that's great.
Going green with blue.
We want to be very environmentally responsible here at the FEC. So I just want to confirm that that is indeed my colleague's understanding of what these letters mean, because I appreciate Commissioner Hunter saying that, I think I heard her say that she does agree with that concept, although I disagree when she said she didn't think it was squarely before us, because I think it actually is quite squarely before us, and I just need to be assured of that proposition.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you for the clarification. I agree that we are substituting the letters with the agenda document 18.7C, and I am willing to vote for those due to the concerns of my colleagues. I'm not sure that we need the language in there that we discussed, but in this case, I'm perfectly willing to vote for that language due to your concerns. One of the things I was addressing in my previous comments is that I don't think the question of what is the point of no return, and at what point does the commission need to really examine whether or not someone may be able to withdraw? That's not before us today because of the fact that the senator did not accept any public funding. So for me here, a lot of those issues that we've discussed are not necessarily relevant because of the fact, again, in regulation 9035.2D, that the senator did not accept any public funds. But I am willing to support that language. Thank you.
Does that help?
That does help. That does help. And that's also.
Does that help us a certain direction?
Commissioner Peterson. Yes.
It did?
It's we're making progress. Don't worry.
Always progress. Never know if that means motion, though. Progress is always subjective.
I just wanted to seek clarification from my other colleagues. That's all.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In looking through these drafts, my understanding was the same as Commissioner Hunter's, that the issue of whether or not the commission must have an affirmative four vote majority in order to release someone from the matching payment program, my understanding was that was not before us and wasn't necessarily even implicated by this letter. Maybe the case that I'm one of six who doesn't have that understanding for a number of constitutional, legal, and policy-related reasons. I do not.
Point of order, but the letter does say what it says, right?
Yes.
I agree that it says what it says.
Yes, okay. I do. By definition, the letter does say what it says. So, my interpretation of that letter is not confirming that in all instances the commission necessarily must take a vote and have a majority of four before someone who's within the matching payments program, that four vote is are necessary before that they can be released from the program. So,
if I could jump in, maybe bring some more clarity to this. My view of this issue began a completely different premise than I think most, because I came at it really much more from the fact that the government can't force participation in what the U.S. Supreme Court has said is a voluntary program. The reason why we can have matching funds and taxpayer money funding campaigns is due to the voluntariness of the program. Buckley Court made that clear. Subsequent courts dealing with similar state laws made that clear. So my initial reaction was if someone wants to withdraw, they can withdraw. But then, based in large part because of the very thoughtful analysis of the vice chair, many conversations with him thinking through these issues certainly helped my thinking and brought me much further down the analysis than a simple analysis. I don't think we reached the constitutional issue, so it makes it easier. I think that ultimately the commission has certified a candidate, and the commission has to, if the facts warrant, withdraw the certification. I emphasize as the facts warrant. So there is some commission decision that occurs here. And I believe that to withdraw the certification does require a commission vote. Certainly, I'm not comfortable signing a letter on behalf of the commission that did not receive a commission vote in a commission meeting to withdraw certification. I don't think it's something that the chairman can just go off and do, so therefore it must be something that requires a vote. So it certainly requires a vote. Commission has already addressed this issue in other contexts. I think there is some precedent here as to how the commission treats them, the Dean matter, the Gephardt matter, and the Dole matter, and then the Gephardt advisory opinion itself not only echoes the Buckley language. The commission has acknowledged that when Congress can puts into place a public financing system, it has to be voluntary, but it may condition acceptance of funds on an agreement by the candidate to abide by the spending cap. So actually, the Supreme Court language, as cited by the Commission AO, does require acceptance of funds. With respect to the loan, I agree with much of what Commissioner Bowerly said. I have one minor point of disagreement. That's on the loan itself. I think that, as the loan agreement says, it was not the matching funds were not pledged as some sort of security or collateral. I think it's clear, at least to me, that the folks who put the loan agreements together had read the Gephardt AO and were trying very hard to come within its protections. And I think they ought to be afforded those protections for having taken action in reliance upon a commission ruling. But with respect to whether or not there's other collateral, I think they're without really addressing that issue, because I don't think this is the context to get into it, but I want to point to at least one other prior commission matter, an enforcement matter regarding the Teamsters PAC, the Democrat Republican Independent Voter Education PAC, otherwise DRIVE PAC. It's MER 5766, which provides a very good analysis on how the commission treats loans secured by future monies or property or other things. And the commission has, at least in one MER, seemed to agree that loan agreements of that sort are perfectly permissible and well within bounds. So I don't really have much more to say on the loan agreement, because I don't really think it's necessarily, at least how I approach the issue, something that I had to spend a lot of time on. But I do have some concern on remaining consistent with how the commission operates. And the Gephardt advisory opinion does provide some guidance on that, where it essentially says that if someone lets us know that he wants to get out of the program, the commission will then withdraw the certification. And that is what I think we're going to do here today. And I think the letter that is has gone around does that. And that's why I'm willing to support the council's recommendation as amended by that letter. And to me, it is the way to proceed, because it is the way the commission has proceeded in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I hear a consensus that supports the statement in the plain words of the letter that says responding to this request does require the exercise of the discretion of the commission. And as I said, it's a really key fact for me. It's interesting for me to listen to counsel analyze what did the commission mean when it issued the Gephardt AO, since I actually was here. I actually signed the Gephardt AO, not only voted for it, but signed it. And you are correct that the AO does say that candidates can withdraw, that the commission will withdraw certifications. What it says precisely is, in light of the terms of the Matching Payment Act, its judicial construction, its legislative history, and the other policy considerations discussed above, the commission would withdraw certification of a candidate's eligibility to receive Matching Payment Act funds prior to the payment date for any such funds to such candidate or his or her committee upon receipt of a written request signed by the candidate, provided that the certification of funds has not been pledged as security for private financing. That is the language that the commission, on a unanimous vote, approved. And it was not language that went unnoticed, because, in fact, for purposes of clarity, when we discussed the opinion at the table, we actually moved that language from a different place in the opinion into that sentence. So everyone at the table knew the language was there. They looked at that language, they approved that language, and believed that to be a statement of the law. It's true that it's not a rulemaking, an AO, but it does reflect, I believe, what five commissioners at the time, because one was absent that day, believed to be an accurate statement of the law. And I think quite plainly, Senator McCain and his lawyers were well aware of that. And whether they were trying to comply with it or do an end run on it, I'm not entirely sure at this point in time, but they certainly knew that that was the existing statement of the law from the commission. The pledge issue is difficult for me. I think it's a troubling set of documents because I think there was some very careful maneuvering in those loan documents. The bank needed security for their loan. Our regulations require it, but they also, for their own sake, obviously would want to have a basis to make sure that they were going to be repaid. Now, if Senator McCain were successful, that was easy. Everybody, I think, would assume that he'd be able to repay the loan if his campaign took off. Back when these loan documents were executed, that was very much up in the air. I don't think that it was at all considered a sure thing back in November and December of last year that Senator McCain would ultimately win the nomination. And props to him for taking a campaign that was really at one point virtually bankrupt and retooling and turning it around and turning it into a winning campaign. He did an unbelievable job with that. But it is true that at that point in time, he had practically no money. Without the loans in December, he would have been in the red. So he really needed those loans, and the bank needed to know how he was going to pay them back if indeed he was not successful. And I think that it would have been, aside from complying with our rules, it would have been crazy for the bank to enter into that transaction without some assurance that it could be paid back if he were not to be successful. So what was that security? There really wasn't much there besides this promise that ultimately they could get at the public funding. They wrote it in an unusual way. We have been looking at loan documents for candidates in this building for 30 years, and we've never seen one quite like that before. But, candidates can be innovative. That's fine. We encourage innovation. But this one really was unusual in the way it was drafted. And we've seen that the commission has looked at a lot of loan documents. We looked in the last cycle at John Kerry's loan, which was secured by his real estate, and somebody filed a complaint and said, gee, we don't think the real estate was worth enough to have secured a loan of that amount, and the commission actually looked into whether the property was worth that much and determined that it was. But this is not a new question for the commission to have to take a look at whether the security that's put up for a loan to a presidential candidate is adequate. And as we learned from Senator John Glenn, if the campaign goes south, it's very, very difficult to repay acquired debt from a failed presidential campaign, even for a senator and a legitimate hero of America. Senator Glenn was never able to repay the debts on his campaign. He just couldn't raise the money, and it's always hard for any candidate, presidential or senatorial, to retire debt, because nobody wants to put money into retiring debt. So I think it was not a small matter whether there was going to be something that the bank could turn to, and it's a tough choice how you analyze this. There are not good results here either way, because if the public funds were not the security for this loan, then I think, one can really question whether there was adequate security for this loan at all. And if there wasn't adequate security for the loan, that would be actually a much bigger problem for the campaign, because if there were no security for the loan, then it is arguably an in-kind contribution, the entire amount of the loan, to the candidate's committee. And that, I think, would be a much worse situation for the candidate to find himself in. So I actually think that finding that the public funds were the security for the loan is in some sense a favor to the candidate. puts them in a better place. But one does have to come back to the Gephardt language, provided that the certification of funds has not been pledged to security for private financing. Was it or wasn't it? You know, it sure looks like a pledge to me, because there wasn't anything else there. They promised that they would provide these funds if that was the only way to pay back the loan. So I have a lot of problems with the way this loan was written and how it all comes before us. Now, it's true that the senator was in a very, in kind of a pickle in February when we didn't have four commissioners to deal with a request. However, he wasn't in that situation in November when he first, or perhaps in October when he first started negotiating those loans. And I actually would have preferred, I think the senator would have been better served had he sent in an advisory opinion request back last fall when he was thinking about doing this. There were five commissioners back then, and we were taking steps to answer questions quickly when we could. And I think that it had that request come in asking us head on to reconsider the language in the Gephardt AO, I'm pretty sure that we would have turned that one around and given him an answer. And I think that as important as the chairman thinks it is to stay within the bounds of previous advisory opinions, I think that there are times when one can reconsider. And I would have been prepared then, and I am prepared now, to reconsider the reasoning of the Gephardt AO in that statement that the certification of funds is the that pledging the certification of the funds is the trigger, is the no return point. Because I think one does have to reach a point of no return. Otherwise, somebody could take public funds and actually take receipt of the money and then change their mind and say, you know what, now my campaign's taking off, so I'm going to pay the money back to the government and not abide by the expenditure limits. And that, it seems to me, would be a very bad situation. It sort of turns us into an interest-free bank for candidates. So the question is, what is that point of no return? And I'm prepared. It's an odd circumstance to be in. As I said, we would have been better served had the advisory opinion request come in back last fall, because we can't supersede an advisory opinion sitting around here talking at the table. But I'm prepared to reconsider the legal principles that were embodied in that advisory opinion request. And, you know, should we receive an advisory opinion request in the future, obviously it would be embodied in that. Because I think that, as troubling as I find this loan and all the shenanigans with the way it was written, where it's not collateral, but it is collateral, but it could be collateral, and it might be in the future collateral, it sure looks like a pledge to me. Sort of reminds me of that Magritte painting, where it's a painting of a pipe, but the heading underneath the caption of the painting is, this is not a pipe. And that's sort of the way these loan documents read to me. They say, this isn't collateral, but they sure seem to be using it to secure the loan. However, when I look at the broader picture of where we would have been, you know, even assuming there was a full commission back in February, would it have served public policy to have told Senator McCain at that point, you're stuck with the limits, and you're going to have to abide by limits that your opponents are not abiding by, you know, by their choice, voluntary basis? I think that probably would not have been a good result for this election season or for the country in terms of vetting the issues in the campaign and making sure that we have a fully and fairly fought election, which is, after all, what we want to do. I think one can argue about actual receipt versus constructive receipt and whether pledging the funds, it does indeed come within the regulation that the vice chairman was reading earlier. He did get benefits from the from his eligibility for public funding. He got the loan, obviously, which he needed very much at that point. But he also was able to get on the ballot in at least Ohio and perhaps some other states, I'm not exactly sure, in a way that saved a lot of resources for him that other candidates had to expend. So there was a competitive advantage to him vis-a-vis his primary opponents in being eligible and getting himself eligible for public funding and having the commission give him that letter originally. So I think it is, as I said, a difficult case that can be argued both ways, but given what I believe to be the consensus that it is our decision to make, which, as I said, is a really important threshold question for me, I am willing to reconsider what I believe to have been the governing law as stated by the Commission in the Gephardt advisory opinion, and allow and approve the letters on the basis that, not on the basis that's stated in counsel's opinion necessarily, but on the basis that he did not actually receive the funds. I think that an argument can be made for constructive receipt, but he did not actually receive the funds. And just as I approve the Obama AO in the spirit that we ought to be encouraging people to participate and therefore not place high hurdles on them once they have submitted their application, I think that I'm prepared to vote in favor of this.
That made me thirsty.
Sorry, made me thirsty too.
I had to get a glass of water. Any other thoughts, comments, concerns? Do we have any motions? I think we're looking for a motion on the council's recommendation, and then we'll probably have a second motion amending the council's recommendation. But that's my suspicion as what people may want to do. So then on the table is the actual letter. I think procedurally that's the way to go if someone has an input.
Just a question. I mean, we can vote on the council's recommendation. I'll vote no on that. But I wonder if we need to do that, or whether what we need to do is to approve the sending of these letters. We can do it either way.
Well, the recommendation, as I read it, and I'm on page 17 of 18, Roman number 5 recommendation, the Office of General Counsel recommends that the Commission, that's the part I'm focused on, one, withdraw the certification of the to the Secretary of the Treasury that Senator McCain and John McCain 2008 Inc. are entitled to payment from the Matching Payment Act account, and two, approve the attached letters to counsel for Senator McCain and John McCain 2008 Inc. and the United States Treasury. I think we're going to substitute in the letters with a revised letter, so the vote would be on, are we going to withdraw, and then approving the letter withdrawing the certification? I think that's the recommendation, and that's the actual vote, is really essentially on the letter. Now, how we couch that, I'm curious to if everyone's going to make a motion on this, and we can just move the letter. It sidestepped the first question, but to me, it's really the vote on the letter is a vote on the letter.
As I said, Mr. Chairman, if you want to vote on the council's recommendation, I'm sure that it will carry, and I'll vote no because I don't agree with the analysis in the lengthy and detailed, and I appreciate all the hard work that went into it.
We concur in the result, though. We can maybe vote affirmatively for the result.
But I will be willing to vote to send the letters if that is a separate vote.
That's the only. Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that's the only vote at this point that we're going.
Well, there's no vote right now. There's no motion. I'm looking for a motion as to what we're actually going to vote on. And if the consensus is we simply want to vote on the letter, then someone can make a motion to that effect. That if they want to actually vote on the recommendation to withdraw the certification and then memorialize that in a letter that's part of the same vote, they can do that. Traditionally, chairman don't make the motion. Someone else makes the motion. Commissioner Bowerly may
chairman.
Have a motion.
I would move that we, someone can amend my motion if they feel like I've mischaracterized something, that we withdraw the certification of Senator McCain in the matching fund program,
okay.
Grant his request, and approve the letters that are identified as 817C.
Version of the letter. All right, we have a motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? No. 6-0 passes to send a letter to the Department of Treasury. That makes me feel good, so now I can sign the letter, because now I know I have the commission approval. Before everybody runs off, and one more item on the agenda, the agenda, administrative matters and the like. announcement more for the public. Regulations, we're going to start doing those again. We have a regulations committee, which I don't think is a secret. Commissioners Hunter and Weintraub are going to be working very diligently on that, and we have they have come together, and we've already put in place a schedule, I think, at least tentatively, on different topics of rulemakings. As I understand it, the bundling rules, the reality is they cannot take effect this election cycle. Under the APA, it takes some time to put rules in place with notice and comment and the like, and there's a three-month window there before they become effective. The goal, the shared goal, is to get those in effect by next election cycle, so that people are moving forward under the law. I think we're shooting for a hearing the week of September 15th, in the middle of that week, but we need to check with the witnesses to make sure the witnesses are available. We have not done that. We've only gotten so far as to check our own schedules, and now we have to contact each of the witnesses to make sure everyone has a full opportunity to comment and participate in that process. The other rulemaking that's going to go on, well, two others in the short term, Shays 3, we call it. Is no secret, it's already been reported by at least one publication. We have not appealed the DC Circuit's decision in Shays 3, so there will be a rulemaking. We're going to try to do that this year, but the reality is it'll probably be in the winter. So it'll be a little bit this year, a little bit next year, and try to get that done. The Millionaires Amendment rulemaking will also get going. That is in the result of the FEC versus Davis case, where the court struck down some provisions of the so-called Millionaires Amendment. As we learned today in the Lautenberg AO, it's only some provisions, but that requires rulemaking because the reporting forms have to be changed, some of the regs have to be peeled out and reworked, and then sometimes things that maybe made sense with some other clause all of a sudden don't make clause, seem to cross-reference the regs and that kind of thing. It's very time-intensive to do, and we're going to endeavor to do that. The travel regs, prior commission had done quite a bit of work. I think right now the commissioners are reviewing those to see where they stand, and reading through the rules and the other materials that were presented in the rules to see if we can get some sort of plan of action, and then, if assuming there's a plan, what the timing of the plan is. Anyone has any comments on the rules? Those on the committee, if I admitted, thumbs up, nod. Oh, good job. Okay.
I guess I just put in one caveat that I agree we're certainly going to start those Shays rulemakings this fall, winter. What's the last day of winter? I'm not sure. It's I wouldn't want us to be too firm on exactly when we'll wrap those up, because I know that we are going to want to take a good hard look at what's been done before and how we can do better.
Part of that is why we're putting the bundling, though, up front, because Congress did pass a law that requires a rulemaking, and until the rule goes into effect, the statute essentially does not go into effect, unlike the travel rules, which there is a statute that sort of lives and breathes without our interpretation via rulemaking, but that's not the case with bundling, and because the bundling reporting regime is essentially a per-cycle reporting regime, I think we're really going to see if we can get it effective or at least on the books, and if the effective date is somehow in the next cycle, which may end up being the case because of the way the statute is written, so be it, but at least people are going to have guidance so they need to know how to proceed. The prior commission tried to do that, actually, it was the ENJ or the proposed rule noted that it would be essentially effective as of the beginning of this cycle, beginning of 2008, but the hope sprung eternal, but then the hope sprung a leak, and the commission was no longer able to vote. So this is our way to kind of let the public know what's going on with the rulemakings. There's been a lot of questions about it, and we thought it would be worthwhile to announce that. I don't have anything else on the agenda. I'd like to actually thank Chris Healy, who's essentially the deputy general counsel, who's Tommy Duncan, our general counsel, was unable to be here today. He's put a tremendous amount of work into getting today to move smoothly, and we are now on the eve of breaking for lunch, and we've gone through a number of advisory opinions and one of the main presidential candidates' matter in a very short period of time. If it wasn't for his work and his team's work, today would not have happened. Anything else for the good of the order from the commissioners before I ask council's office and staff director if they have anything? Hearing none, Are there any management and administrative matters to be discussed?
There are none.
Thank you. I'd like to adjourn the meeting without objection. So adjourned.